Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. An unusually populous schedule today. Three guests. Natalie Schur will explore how high drug prices are forcing diabetics to forego insulin, resulting literally in loss of life and limb. Then the economist Aaron Medlin outlines the labor market experience of young adults. 95% of those who are employed have regular jobs, and almost none of them are driving Ubers. At the bottom of the hour, Ken Silverstein, the founder of Counterpunch and now proprietor of the Washington Babylon website, will discuss the state of journalism and think tankery in our decadent imperial capital. Insulin has been around for almost a century, but its price has been skyrocketing in recent years. Why, and what has that done to diabetics? Here's Natalie Schur, a writer and researcher based in Los Angeles, who has an article on the topic in the American Prospect, with more. Natalie Schur.
You open your story with the tale of a guy who died because he couldn't afford his insulin. Just give us the numbers.
Sure. You are referring to the story of Alec Rayshon Smith, who was a type 1 diabetic who was diagnosed when he was 23 years old, a little old for type 1 diabetes. And he was on his mother's insurance, got his supplies that way. And when he was about to turn 26, they started running the numbers, realized that on the ACA exchanges in the state of Minnesota, where premiums were particularly high, the combination of premiums and cost sharing would be prohibitive. He was looking at a premium of around $400. He was making $35,000 as a restaurant manager at the time without benefits. So he would be partially subsidized, but still have a full load of cost sharing that his out-of-pocket costs could approach around $7,000, depending on what plan he went with. And so with those numbers, it just made more sense to pay out of pocket for his supplies initially, which ran about $1,000 a month. And that way he would save money on premiums and try to find a job in the meantime. Unfortunately, of course, that didn't happen. The first month that he went in to pay out of pocket for his insulin supplies, they ended up being $1,300. There had been another price hike, so he didn't buy them. He was set to be paid in a few days, and what they think happened is that he went home, figured that he'd try to cut carbs for a couple of days until his paycheck came, and then 5 days later he died of diabetic ketoacidosis, which is a complication typically caused by not having insulin.
And I think a lot of people don't realize how severe diabetes is, right? If you don't have insulin, you die rather quickly, right?
Absolutely. That's particularly true for type 1 diabetics. If they miss just a few doses of insulin, the consequences can be very severe. Type 2 diabetics often still need insulin, but the impact is more likely to be in aggregate. They're more likely to have things like amputations and renal failure if they miss a lot of insulin over time. But definitely type 1 diabetics, over the course of just a couple days, if there's too much blood sugar in their system, there can be a really dire emergency. And so that really lays bare the consequences here.
Now, the usual excuse for high drug prices is that drug companies need the money to do R&D. I want to return to this a little bit, but this is not a new drug. Insulin's been around for a very, very long time, decades and decades, right?
Yeah, insulin has absolutely been on the commercial market since the early 1920s. The early insulins were made out of pork and beef pancreas. Starting in the early 80s, they've been made out of bacteria, so human insulins. The insulin that's on the market now has been around since around 1996, so even the recent price increases aren't justified by these new developments. The same drug's been being used for a couple decades in this case.
And so what's happened over the last 20 years that the price has just skyrocketed?
I think it's a perfect storm of a lot of factors. For one thing, starting in, I think, around 1996, they did get, Lilly got a patent on this new analog insulin. Novo Nordisk, who's one of their only competitors, ended up developing it another way. So they have kind of a parallel analog insulin. But when the drugs are under patent, the patent holder is essentially able to unilaterally dictate prices, which is what Lilly's done. So, you know, the price has steadily climbed since the 90s, but just over the past couple of years, I think that there's a few factors at play here. For one, insurance has gotten worse. So as deductibles have gotten so much higher over just the past couple of years, people are exposed to more costs directly. More people also have co-insurance instead of co-payments, which means that they are paying a steadily rising percentage of overall costs as opposed to a flat co-pay rate. And over the past couple of years, we also see PBMs, pharmaceutical benefit managers, that are basically recouping rebates that are a percentage of overall costs. And there's some belief that in the insulin space in particular, they are a pretty bad actor keeping prices higher than they need be because they're getting large rebates from it.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about these PBMs. When I first heard of them, probably about 15 years ago, I thought, I don't get the point of this. What is adding another middleman to this process going to do for us? In theory, they're supposed to keep down costs. In practice, they do anything but, right?
Yeah, so PBMs, I think, have to be understood in a very specific context, which is in the American healthcare system. In the American healthcare system, we don't regulate prices. There's no single-payer government negotiator. There's not tight regulation at the top. And so individual payers negotiate prices for, healthcare services and drugs. PBMs specifically kind of rose out of this problem, telling employers and insurance plans that they would be able to better negotiate prices for drugs in particular for health plans. And they would be able to leverage a larger scale, which of course is what a single payer can do in the first place. But so they were basically coming into a market failure in the U.S. system, saying that they could do it better, but the way that they're paid really complicates that. They aren't incentivized to keep prices down necessarily because they're paid in rebates. So they're paid in a percentage of overall drug costs, and so they don't really have a strong reason to try to get the best price possible. In some cases, they actually want a higher price because, of course, then their percentage, their cut is higher. And it seems as if that's what's happening in the insulin space, but at times these are notoriously difficult to figure out. They don't make these numbers public. Lilly and Novo Nordisk have certainly pointed their finger at PBMs. They're probably not the most nefarious player, but they're definitely having an impact.
And according to textbook capitalism, if you have a high price like this and exorbitant profits resulting, there should be new entrants coming in at a lower price seeking to capture a piece of this market. What is preventing competitors from entering this market, given that insulin is not a fancy new drug with a lot of patents on it? It's been around for almost 100 years. So what's preventing textbook capitalism from kicking in here?
Well, the answer is sort of complicated. As I mentioned, the insulin that was around 100 years ago is different than the insulin that is used now. And so, you know, each of those improvements came with new patents, came with new market protection. But even given that, the most popular insulins have been off patent for several years now. Usually what happens when a drug is off patent, the way that the price goes down is that generic manufacturers enter the market. When enough do, they eventually compete the price down, the price falls. This doesn't happen when the first generic manufacturer comes into the space. It, you know, research shows that it usually takes several before that happens, but often it happens eventually. The reason that this hasn't happened with insulin is because it's not regulated as a simple drug. It's regulated as something called a biologic drug because it's made from bacteria and not a simple molecule. This kicks in a lot of different issues. Basically, when a conventional drug is made into a generic, that is able to happen and that market is able to flourish because they are considered to be perfectly interchangeable. And laws at the state level typically empower pharmacists to be able to replace the drug with a generic that then allows that generic to hit market. The situation is a bit different with biologics. They are not as interchangeable, according to conventional wisdom, as normal drugs. There's now a regulatory pathway. There was just an FDA hearing last month, actually, while I was reporting this story, that might change that and make biologics more like conventional generics. But I do think that it's particularly difficult when it comes to insulin, because insulin, if the differences between one type of insulin and another are fairly minimal from an actual scientific standpoint, for actual patients, they can be considerable. Something like one type of insulin might have to be taken 20 minutes before a meal, and another type of insulin has to be taken 40 minutes before a meal. And the management of diabetes really depends on militantly minimizing the fluctuation between blood sugar levels at different parts of the day. So the difference between, 20-minute spike before meals and 40-minute spike before meals is pretty huge. And so I think that there's probably less willingness to change types of insulin for patients who are already used to one kind. And so even if someone were able to figure out the biologic regulatory framework, I think that you would basically have to wait until people had been grandfathered into a new generic insulin and were then used to that one before you saw a price fall, which of course could be decades from now. And it just doesn't seem to me to be, the feasible mechanism by which to reduce prices the way you might see with other drugs.
Diabetes is an extremely common disease. Lots of people need insulin, so this is a pretty big problem. How widespread is the foregoing of buying insulin just because people can't afford it? How many people are just priced out of the market for a life-saving drug?
That's something that researchers are just starting to understand, and preliminarily, that number looks huge. Dr. Kasia Lipska, who is in my story, just led a team at the Yale Diabetes Clinic that found that around 1 out of 4 patients are actively rationing their insulin. So that means not taking doses, stretching doses out, doing things along those lines. And those are just people who are taking less insulin because of costs. That doesn't reflect people who are making other really difficult trade-offs, who are maybe cutting down on grocery bills or, having to move in with family members or, switch housing because they can't afford their drugs. So I think that, taken all together, the economic toll that insulin has on patients is massive.
Earlier, we touched on this, but let's go back to it in some more detail. The claim of the pharmaceutical industry and its apologists is that they need high profits to finance research. In this case, the basic insulin was discovered almost 100 years ago, but then the recombinant versions, the high-tech DNA versions, that's about 20 years ago, and that was not financed, the basic science was not financed by Eli Lilly and drug companies like that. What about that claim? Does these high prices at all justified because of the need to finance drug development?
That is a very common claim, and I, came right out with that claim in my piece because I do think that, when you really break down that claim, especially for insulin, it just doesn't hold much water. You're right that a lot of these recombinant DNA technologies came out of government-funded research in the 50s and 60s. The government is, the source of a ton of R&D in general, for many industries, particularly for the pharmaceutical industry. They did put in around $40 million into the drug that would become Humulin in the late 70s and early 80s. Even at the time, adjusting for inflation, $40 million is, more than I've got to invest in a new technology. But judging from actual profit margins for Humulin in particular is, a tiny, tiny piece. When you also break down what big pharma spends on R&D versus what it spends on marketing, you'll see that the latter is a lot higher. Ultimately, I think that, their prices are so high to justify high valuations and large investments from investors than it is to fuel R&D. Not to mention the fact that, as I mentioned, the version of the drug that they do have, which is an improvement on the original pork and beef insulins, has been around since 1996. So they haven't been innovating on that. They haven't been changing it. That's been, what some diabetics have taken all of their lives, and those prices have gone up. So it's really hard to use the innovation argument for a drug that hasn't changed in 20 years.
And then finally, the political question. What does insulin cost up there in the Soviet Republic of Canada?
Insulin there costs around $30 a vial. So that's, $30 for the vials that cost around $275 here. And the typical diabetic probably uses 2 or 3 vials a month. So, you know, it's still a difficult cost for the very poorest patients. I don't want to, you know, act as if that's nothing. But the difference between $90 a month and, you know, nearly $900 a month is certainly the difference between life and death for many patients.
And what accounts for that difference?
I mean, you know, Canada, like other countries, have been more aggressive in cost control at the top. They haven't just allowed pharmaceutical companies to name their prices, and that's made all the difference. You know, I don't want to completely romanticize Canada's drug policy. In many provinces, they don't include pharmaceutical benefits in their single-payer system, and, you know, a lot of activists would identify that as a flaw. But certainly in terms of insulin, they don't have the massive cost problems that we do.
That was the LA-based writer and researcher Natalie Schur. You can find her article on insulin in the American Prospects website. Next, young adults, specifically those aged 21 to 25, in the job market. You might think they're all doing gig work, driving Ubers and waiting for a text from TaskRabbit, but very few are. Here's the economist Aaron Medlin, co-author of a paper on the topic from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with more. Aaron Medlin.
If you read the papers and listen to people talking in bars, all young people these days are juggling three Uber jobs, working as baristas even though they have a college degree. These memes that pass around don't really have a firm basis in reality, do they?
I mean, not based on the data that we're seeing. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have a survey that they did in 2005 called the Continuing Worker Survey. They hadn't done a survey like that in basically 12 years, so they recently did it in 2017. And basically what we found is that overwhelmingly young people, you know, between the ages of 21 and 25, were overwhelmingly opting for standard work arrangements. You know, basically what we mean by that are like permanent jobs with, you know, a standard employer-employee relationship. And this could be full-time or part-time. And they're choosing that as opposed to things like gig work, which kind of falls under the category of non-standard relationships. You know, so that could be any kind of freelancer, an independent contractor, which most gig workers are classified as for most of these employers like Uber and Lyft. Yeah, this is a bit surprising.
Yeah, and we're talking about overwhelming numbers, right? 94%, 95%.
That's exactly right, yeah. So back in 2005, it was about 94, and it's only increased to about 95%.
And then how does this compare with the broader population?
For the broader population, it's, you know, it's only about 90%. 90% are basically engaged in standard work.
But I think that would even surprise a lot of people. Who think that, you know, everyone's juggling six part-time jobs with, you know, no security at all.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But what we actually end up seeing is the percentage of basically people who have multiple jobs has actually been declining for the workforce overall. It has also been going down for young people, ages 21 to 25.
There are several kinds of non-standard work arrangements, you know, that other 5% or so. What do we mean by non-standard arrangements? What kind of jobs are those?
So those are like your independent contractors, many construction workers. You even have day laborers fit into that category. Freelancers, some of which may get some of their clients online and work online, but might contract work in other ways. And then you also have your temp agency workers, right? So young people working for a temp agency when they're moving around from kind of from one employer to another or one job to another.
And again, these numbers are very small and smaller for young people than the general population.
That's correct. So, I mean, since, you know, 90% of the total population that's currently employed is in standard work, and then you have 95% that are of young people from 21 to 25 who are employed in standard work. Yeah, this is a very small population. And then when you get to the gig economy, those employed in various kinds of gig work, and that could be on a primary basis, secondary basis, or just as kind of like a side gig, earning a little supplementary income, it's even smaller, about 1%.
And that is precisely not what a lot of people will think is going on these days, right?
Yeah, it is a somewhat surprising finding, particularly given that general narrative that's, you know, been building up over the last few years, you know, about the changing nature of work and these new digital platforms that are creating basically new interfacing with customers. And while we do see some of that new forms of interfacing with customers and delivering different services, we're not necessarily seeing major changes in the way in employment relations, as has been predicted by much of the media.
And now what about the demographics under the surface of these averages, college degree versus not college degree? What kinds of picture do we see there?
In terms of non-standard, or in terms of non-standard work, that has been going down for both college degree holders and non-college degree holders. Certainly, those with a college four-year degree are doing a bit better on that front. But positively, we do see that even for non-college degree holders, that is a trend that's been going down in terms of opting for non-standard work.
And then, what about gender and race under the surface?
For women, it has been an improvement, particularly for those with less than a college degree, and for men as well, between 2005 and 2017. For women with a college degree, you know, it's about the same. It didn't change much. And so we do see an improvement across the board for men and women opting for standard work for non-college degree holders, and then a little bit of an improvement for men and who do have a college degree.
Now, what you keep saying opting for, but you know, I think in the standard narrative, this is just all that's on offer. People have no choice in the matter. That's just take it or leave it. But that's really not an accurate picture.
I mean, correct. It's difficult to say like what their it seems like what their preferences are. But you know, when we see these types of numbers, that seems to be, you know, what's happening is the availability of different interfacing platforms and the ability to try to do freelance work and get different kinds of gig jobs has only increased since 2005. And so clearly that choice has been available to them. But instead they appear to be opting for the standard employer relationship.
And now what about earnings? I mean, we're also hearing that there's really no benefit in going to college, that you know, the wage premium just isn't worthwhile. Is that true?
For college degree holders, their wages have not really improved since 2005. And in fact, they are a bit lower. But we do see an increase for those with less than a college degree. So we've seen improvement in their, you know, in their median earnings has improved slightly, whereas, you know, those with a college degree, it's dropped a bit.
But on the other hand, the workers in traditional arrangements with a college degree earn more than those without a degree.
That's correct, yeah. So overall, if you have a college degree, you're still earning more than those without. But since 2005, your earnings just really haven't budged that much. In fact, they've gone down a little bit at the median level.
Yeah, so we have a picture of like broad wage stagnation, but there's still a college premium that exists.
That's correct, yep.
And then benefits, what do we see in that department?
Generally, a pretty good improvement. So more young people have access to health insurance, and that comes from various sources. So certainly the Affordable Care Act has played a role in that, since young people now are able to stay on their parents' plans until the age of 26. We see a really remarkable rise in the number of young people covered. And also, a lot more of them have retirement plans, particularly for college degree holders. And also very interestingly, we see a major kind of increase in unionization rates, whereas in like 2005, we were in around 6% for college degree holders and around 4% for non-college degree holders. Well, both those numbers have now almost doubled. And so we see a much higher unionization rate among young people than we did before.
But the share of workers, even with a college degree, young workers with a college degree who have a retirement plan is still small. It's like less than half.
That is correct. That is true. So there's been some improvement, but it's still less than half. And it's even worse for those without a college degree, only about 20%.
Now, we don't want to draw a conclusion from this that the labor market is a sweet and rosy place. So what kind of broad conclusions can we draw from this research?
In terms of overall, it is a bit of a mixed picture. So we have seen very robust growth in terms of the total number of jobs for young people who do have a college degree, but we've seen relatively less growth for those without a college degree. And then we also see an uptick in part-time work, particularly for those without a college degree. And now that's almost a third of those without a college degree between 21 and 25 are in part-time work. Can't really conclude anything from that, like if that's voluntary or involuntary, because the that's just not a parameter in the data. But that does seem to be a bit of a worrying trend. And then you also have wages, you know, like we just said, a bit of stagnation there for those with a college degree relative to pre-recession levels. And then we, again, have a little more positive picture in terms of health insurance and benefits, but it's overall, you know, there's certainly room for improvement.
So I think, you know, the conclusion I would draw from this is that we need to be worrying about the quality of jobs and what they pay some, much more than we worry about the fleetingness of them or the tenuous nature of employment.
That's correct. Yeah, I would agree with that. That's definitely a conclusion that we draw in the report.
That was Aaron Medlin, a research intern with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find his paper, co-written with Hai-Jian Ro, on their website, cepr.net. By the way, the so-called college premium, the wage advantage enjoyed by those with a bachelor's degree or more over those with only a high school education, is now about 48%. In other words, completing college means you'll earn, on average, half again as much as those who only finish high school. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the third movement of Haydn's Symphony No. 78, performed by the Austro-Hungarian Haydn Orchestra under Adam Fischer. Next, doing journalism in the swamp. Ken Silverstein is one of the few against-the-grain journalists operating in Washington. He founded Counterpunch, then a newsletter and now a website, in 1994. Alexander Coburn joined him in the venture soon after, as did Jeffrey St. Clair. Ken left Counterpunch and went to work for, among others, AP, the LA Times, and Harper's. He launched the muckraking website Washington Babylon in 2016, named after a book he co-wrote with Coburn in 1996. Its tagline says it all, shocking true stories and political sleaze. It's on the web at washingtonbabylon.com. Ken Silverstein.
So, Ken, I've been reading up on the history of the Council on Foreign Relations, the conspiracy theorist's favorite organization. But one of the things that struck me was their relationship with journalists. Journalists are part of the council. They have favored journalists. They leak things to journalists. They're part of the whole apparatus of governance of which the council is almost like a, or had been, maybe not so much anymore, but had been almost a part of the government. Is that the way Washington journalism works these days, too? I mean, is it as if a certain brand of favored journalists is almost part of the governance structure?
I don't think there's any question about that at this point. I'll make an analogy here. I think journalists are like think tanks. They're extremely valuable to people in power because there's an appearance of independence and contrariness and open debate, and there's nothing of the sort. I mean, think tanks, as I reported on for a couple of years quite intensely, are captives of their major donors. You know, that was known to a certain extent, but what I was able to find before the New York Times did a fairly lame job, I would say, in comparison and in my modest opinion, what I found was that there were donor programs like, you know, membership rewards on a credit card. The more you gave, the more you got from think tanks. So, you know, if you gave I'm making these numbers up. It's been years. $100,000, you could have an event where any event you wanted, you got the right to pick the panelists and, you know, they would coordinate. So it would look like an independent event. But, you know, if your issue was Caspian Sea oil, that was actually a real example. You could hold an event that looked independent, but it was set up by the think tank at the behest of the donors. And it was very, very valuable to the donors, which happened to be oil companies like Chevron and Exxon, because a think tank looks independent. So it's not obvious, like when you hire a lobbyist or when you basically bribe a member of Congress by paying for his campaign, you know, and you know that you can get him or her to do whatever you want. So think tanks are really valuable because they're undisclosed lobbyists. Journalism isn't quite at that level of corruption, but it's like maybe a notch above or a notch below, however you want to look at it. Journalists are seamlessly integrated into the ruling class, you know, at the upper ends, at the high end journalists. I'm not going to say all of them because, you know, hey, I worked at the LA Times for a while. I was at Harper's with Vice. That was not a staff job, but I had a staff job at Harper's. I've written for all sorts of places. But at the LA Times back in the day, now their staff has been devastated, but you'll always find some good journalists. I mean, you'll find good journalists at the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, I don't want to be completely conspiratorial about it. You'll also find, however, good, smart, independent people at think tanks. But institutionally, the media is as corrupt as the think tank world is. It's as corrupt as Washington is, which means to say almost entirely corrupt. And journalists are always going to be valued because the appearance of independence. If a journalist says it, I know you'll remember this example, Doug. Remember when one of the absolute most atrocious journalists in modern American history, Jeffrey Goldberg, who had a platform at the New Yorker and then failed upward to the Atlantic, when he just created these preposterous stories about Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden being best friends and completely in bed together and how Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, Dick Cheney, then vice president, went on Meet the Press or one of those idiot Sunday shows and said, even the liberal New Yorker says that bin Laden and Saddam are two peas in a pod and that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. And in a way, it's sort of interesting because I've spent some time in the mainstream press, I've actually been a little bit more indulgent than some people because I have found there are really, really smart, valuable, creative colleagues at some of the places I've worked at. But for the most part, it's a rancid industry filled with rancid people. And, you know, people that you and I have both admired over the years, I sometimes in the past thought that people like, you know, our mutual friend Alex Coburn, dearly departed, Noam Chomsky, who I deeply admire. But I used to think that manufacturing consent, which Chomsky wrote with Herman, was too simplistic. And now I think, if anything, he was too generous. It's an appalling state of affairs.
Well, and the journalistic labor market is very tiered, though. I mean, you have, you know, people like Bob Woodward, who are, you know, handmaidens to the stars, but then you have people who are barely getting by. We inhabit the barely getting by level of the profession, but...
We do.
But somebody like Woodward, you know, like, how does somebody like Woodward work?
As you know, he largely works as a stenographer. I mean, literally. That's literally what he does. He interviews people, he takes down their notes, and then he presents an 800-page book or a 700. I've never read anything he wrote. I mean, the funniest thing I ever heard about Bob Woodward was, I think it was, it was about his book about Belushi. It was Cindy, oh my God, what's her name? She's a comedian. I can't remember who said it, but it was somebody from Belushi's circle who read Woodward's book about Belushi. This was his attempt to be hip after, you know, he helped bring down Nixon. He wrote this book about Belushi, and Penny Marshall, not Cindy, said his book was so false that it made her wonder if Nixon wasn't innocent. What Woodward does is he gets access. Everybody wants to talk to them because they know he works for the Washington Post, so it's guaranteed that every piece of dog he publishes will be on the front page of the Post, and the Post will hype the hell out of it. And, you know, he's a brand name, and so everybody wants to talk to him. And then he writes down what they say, and he puts it into a big book. He does no analysis. It's almost like he assumes everything he tells them is correct. And so There's no point of view to anything he says, which is a journalist. The idea that's so preposterous is that we're not supposed to have a point of view. I mean, what is more ridiculous than a professional political writer not having a point of view? What, are we so stupid we can't use our brains to reach conclusions?
Ben Bradley didn't vote, right, because he didn't want to have a political bias.
No, it wasn't Ben Bradley. He has various crimes on his resume. That was Len Downey. Yes, he was so pure, he didn't want to taint himself with the act of voting, which is essentially always bandied about as the highest act of citizenship, and yet he abstained from voting as if somehow by not voting, does that mean he didn't have a preference? By not exercising the right to vote, does that make you a better journalist? I mean, only in Alice in Wonderland. But of course, the other thing which Woodward famously does is just make stuff up. I mean, the book he wrote on the CIA closes with this deathbed scene with William Casey, which anyone can see is completely fictitious. I mean, he pretended he had a deathbed conversation with Casey. And I mean, there's no record of him being at the hospital at the time that Casey was about to expire. But there in his book, there was Bob. So he has succeeded by excelling at what is most cherished in Washington journalism, being a toady to powerful people and making it up when necessary.
Well, the think tank question is interesting, too. The Center for American Progress for a long time didn't want to reveal its donors. At least, well, you know, Brookings and places like that will publish lists of their donors. Cap didn't even want to do that, right? And you got to look at who some of those characters were.
Yes, and that story actually, I did a series of stories for The Nation, which I am grateful to Katrina Vandenheuvel for because she took a lot of heat for publishing those stories from the wonderful Neera Tanden. And Neera succeeded in getting the New Republic to cave to her imperious demands when she found out what I was up to. It wasn't the exact same story, but I was working on a story at the New Republic, and I called Neera for comment, and she called, I can't remember who the editor was then, it was that idiot Franklin Foer. She was a friend of his, and she called him up and complained to him, and he then contacted my editor, Michael Schaefer, now at the Washingtonian. You know, there was just editorial intrusion, because that's the other way Washington works. You know, it's all a big circle jerk. I mean, if you're friends with the right people, you can always call up an editor and have a story killed or altered or changed in a way that's more flattering to you. In this case, I don't believe they killed the story. They just intruded into it. And so I decided, why am I going to bother trying to write about this for the New Republic when I can go to The Nation? So I was able to get list of confidential donors. It was called the Business Something or Other, but it was a secret group within the Center for American Progress that were big business donors, Lockheed. You know, there were oil companies, defense contractors. It was a who's who of the Fortune 500. And they were secretly donating to CAP. And yeah, Brookings, at least you can go to their website. They're not exactly transparent. You know, they'll say they gave between $100,000 and $1 million, or between $1 million and $5 million. Or that was a Clinton Foundation, not a think tank, but speaking of corrupt institutes, the Clinton Foundation was totally transparent the way they described it. But anybody who went to their website, you couldn't find the dates of donations, which allows you to see if somebody was giving money at a time to the Clinton Foundation that they were trying to get a favor out of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. They didn't give amounts. They gave these broad categories. And so a lot of think tanks operate like that. But CAP, astonishingly, until I busted them, they didn't even reveal their big donors. Afterwards, they temporarily became more transparent, but only after I exposed them.
I'm speaking with Ken Silverstein, editor of Washington Babylon.
And now in the Trump era, we have the New York Times publishing these house ads celebrating itself. The truth is so important. You know, the truth is sacred. This is the organization, of course, that published Judy Miller and the lies on Iraq. What has Trump done to the practice of Washington journalism?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure I can give you a really good answer. It's turned the press in some ways into, without putting aside Fox News, which is, better, like it or not, and I generally don't at all, but it is obviously a mainstream news organization at this point. It represents a significant portion of the American public, just the way, unfortunately, MSNBC and CNN do. So Trump has turned the Washington Press Corps more adversarial, but in a way that's sort of immature and very, very unhelpful. The biggest travesty of the last few years, the biggest travesty, biggest media travesty of the Trump era is the whole Russiagate farce. There are things that we still don't know, but the main theory, the central thesis, as propagated by countless thousands of stories in the Times and the Post and other major papers, and, you know, there was, of course, the famous piece by that Claude Jonathan Chait in New York, which speculated that, you know, the Russians began recruiting Trump in 1987 and that he's basically been their tool ever since. The central thesis that Trump was an asset of Vladimir Putin's and would, as president, act as a slavish devotee of Russia is preposterous. It's false. It's flagrantly false. And so there's a Trump derangement syndrome on the part of liberals who I can't stand Trump, but I can evaluate him in the same way I evaluate Obama, who also sucked. I mean, he was a terrible president. You know, Trump, you can say, is worse, and I probably wouldn't argue with you. On some issues, I would say he's actually better than Obama. But it turned the press adversarial, but not because they're critical of power. It's simply that they wanted Hillary because the press represents the elite, and the elite want a careful, cautious custodian of their wealth and power. And that's what Hillary Clinton represented. Donald Trump is reckless. He's not stupid. Anybody who says he's stupid is stupid him or herself. The man is not stupid. He may be mentally frail at times. He is reckless. He is provocative, but he is not stupid. And he has been able, because the press was so reckless, and I love the way the Post and the Times, you know, the custodians of what's good journalism, you know, will trash anybody who uses off-the-record sources, unless it's them. But the entire Russiagate narrative was propagated by major newspapers using off-the-record intelligence sources.
The entire narrative was pushed forward by unnamed intelligence sources. I mean, you can't even trust named intelligence sources, let alone unnamed ones. But the Times and Post and every major outlet, all the news, you know, ABC, NBC, the cable networks, they all were breathlessly reporting stories on the basis of unnamed sources. Look, I hate to even use the term deep state because it immediately puts you, you know, in the world of conspiracy theorists. But you can call it something other than a deep state. You can just call it a political and economic elite. However you want to put it, there, you know, Trump has very powerful enemies. I count myself as an enemy of Trump's, but for different reasons than the New York Times and Washington Post editorial boards. I don't have the money to worry about Trump causing the stock market to melt down. I oppose his immigration policies. I oppose him on most every social policy as he sucks up to the repellent Christian right. But he has powerful enemies within the political and economic elite who didn't want him elected and didn't want him to take office. And those people pushed forward and promoted a bullshit narrative called Russiagate, which proposed that he was a Russian intelligence asset. I mean, there are variations of this, but that, let's face it, look, sure, there were contacts between Trump and the Russian campaign. I'm sure there were contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia. And I'm sure Hillary's people were obviously in touch. They got money from Russians via cutouts. Hillary had closer ties to Russia than Trump did. The difference is that the Clintons aren't stupid enough to send Chelsea to a meeting with Russians. You know, there would have been 6 degrees of separation. But the ties do not amount to collusion, which is not even a legal term anyway, but there was no collusion, in my view, whereby Donald Trump was an asset of the Russians and whereby the Russians wanted him elected because they knew he would do their bidding. And when you get right down to it, there are various iterations of Russiagate, but that is the theme that more than half of the American people believed for the past 2.5 years. Now it's become harder to, you know, even the mainstream media with the Mueller report. Nobody is going down for their ties to Russia. The whole story is impossible to sustain. And I'm not saying that there were no contacts. And I definitely think the Russians, like every foreign government, were smart enough to try to play Trump. So did the Israelis. I'm sure the French did the same thing. Everybody's playing an angle. One can cast doubt on his policies and his integrity, and he says things that are horrible and hateful and disgusting. But, you know, I do think treason is a pretty heavy charge to lay on somebody. And Trump is not a traitor. And that became the Russiagate narrative. He was a traitor to his own country. And that's pretty disgusting. Wherever you stand on the political spectrum, you know, I mean, that's like saying that Obama was a traitor and, you know, the whole birther stuff. It's the same category. And I don't mind people who, you know, hate Trump. I'll be out on the streets. Most of my reporting, I'm doing a lot of reporting now on immigration. I detest his policies, and I am no apologist for this vile president. But, you know, to call somebody a traitor on the basis of unnamed intelligence sources or people like John Brennan, I mean, I hope you can hear the contempt dripping, for, you know, rolling off my tongue. I mean, John Brennan, like, I'm supposed to take that clown seriously? Trust me, it will come out. Brennan is, I accept, a paid commentator or consultant to hedge funds or other entities. I mean, he's just his master's voice. He was a terrible, terrible director of the CIA, and that's a pretty low bar. Liberals fell in love with the FBI and the CIA during this whole Russiagate thing, and this was a narrative that could never have passed muster if the press was not so reckless and irresponsible.
Let's conclude on a gloomy note, the state of journalism today. The economic state of journalism today. You have a lot of people struggling to get by with, you know, websites and tweeting and all this sort of thing, and a handful of elite organizations which are dependent upon the largesse of billionaires. The Washington Post now dependent on Bezos, The Intercept dependent on Pierre Omidyar. How are we supposed to know what the hell is going on in this world in this kind of environment? I don't want to romanticize the past too much, but I recently read Seymour Hersh's memoirs. It's impossible to imagine somebody pursuing the career path of Seymour Hersh today.
Absolutely, and the fact that Seymour Hersh has been basically marginalized and outlawed in his own country. I mean, this is the greatest investigative journalist of his time, and he has a harder and harder time writing for American publications. So not only could one not sustain or chart that career path, but even for Cy, I mean, the man could, you know, I'm sure he could be doing a story a day if somebody would publish him. So it is a pretty gloomy state, and it's very hard to know what's going on. I mean, you know, I struggle to get by with journalism, and I do all sorts of things to make money on the side. But it is very hard to know because, you know, if you're owned by Jeff Bezos, you're not going to aggressively be reporting on Amazon. You just know that the Washington Post is not a neutral arbiter. But that extends beyond Amazon. Journalists know how to succeed now, and they know that falling outside of certain parameters is very, very dangerous to their career. And I think to close on a like on an upbeat note, though, I think we're going to see a revival of journalism because I think journalism has good and bad cycles. We're in a terrible cycle, but I think that cycle is coming to an end. The last good cycle was the, you know, Cy Hersh was the leader of that cycle. And it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of the, you know, protests against the Vietnam War and Watergate and, you know, the impeachment of Nixon and just a general disgust with capitalism and the state of the world and U.S. imperialism, which I won't apologize for using that term. A lot of great reporters grew up in that time. And that's a time of a fractured elite, when you had an elite that was deeply, deeply divided. And that's where we're getting at now. And even more importantly, we're getting to a point where I think that it's going to hit the fan in this country. Unfortunately, Trump will probably win a re-election in 2020. But I'm going to close on an up note. 2024 is our turn. And we are going to be a lot smarter than we were in the 60s. And we were pretty smart back then, too. When I say we, I mean the left. And I think we're going to be stronger. And I think the elite counterattack will not have the same resonance because people are fed up. I have two kids who are completely disillusioned and disgusted by their own government. I mean, God, it took me to, you know, I had to be 25 years old to be completely cynical. My kids are younger than that. They've already outdone me in that regard. So 2024 is our turn. I think the Trump backlash hits not before, I mean, unless there's some stock market crash or something that, you know, really rattles the elites. But there's not a viable Democratic candidate at this point, I don't think, who can beat him. But 2024 is our turn, and that means journalism is going to get better, too, because journalists become less afraid. Sadly, they become less afraid when their masters are a little bit more open-minded. And Katharine Graham, despite all of her flaws, many, many flaws, and Ben Bradley, despite all of his flaws, It's a different world. They grew up in a different time. You know, Jeff Bezos is never going to publish a newspaper that Ben Bradley, and again, if we had more time, we could talk about Ben Bradley. I have lots of problems with him. But it was a paper that was not afraid of powerful people. Today's Washington Post is a joke. But when the shit hits the fan, journalists have more freedom. And I think we'll see a revival of leftist American politics in a few years and a revival of good independent left-wing journalism, too. We're never going to get rich, but we've pretty much bottomed out things. And I'm, you know me, I'm the eternal pessimist. I'm an optimist. I'm optimistic for the first time in a long time. I think things have gotten about as bad as they're going to get, and it's going to get better politically and in journalism.
That was Ken Silverstein, proprietor of the muckraking website Washington Babylon, which you can find, unsurprisingly, at washingtonbabylon.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the finale of Haydn's Symphony No. 78, whose third movement we heard a bit of about 22 minutes ago, performed by the Austro-Hungarian Haydn Orchestra under Adam Fischer. Till next week, bye.